This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
They always tell me not to start the show with numbers, and I try to obey, but these numbers are pretty stark. African-American girls make up 16% of the school population of the U.S., but they are one-third of all school-related arrests in the country.
Overwhelmingly, what these girls had in common was they had failed to have strong student-teacher relationships that could facilitate their well-being in school, and really an inability for the adults in their lives to understand, see, and respond to these conditions.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll talk to a leader in the fight for justice for black girls in school. We'll also spend an academic minute looking at what the change in U.S.-Cuban relations means for race relations on that island. I'm Bob Barron, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. For 4 years, Monique Morris sought out and talked to dozens of young African-American women. Dr. Morris shows how, despite obstacles, stigmas, stereotypes, and despair, black girls still find ways to breathe remarkable dignity into their lives in classrooms, juvenile facilities, and beyond. Those interviews became the basis of her new book called Push Out, The Criminalization of Black Girls in Schools. Monique Morris is co-founder of the National Black Women's Justice Institute. I spoke to Dr. Morris about the book and asked about the title. What is Push Out?
Push out is a term that has been used by advocates to reframe the conditions and the way in which we understand the experiences of young people who have not completed school. Historically, we've used the term dropout, which really does place the focus on the behaviors of the young people rather than exploring the conditions that facilitate a failure to complete school. Push out calls attention to the policies, practices, And in my work, you know, prevailing consciousness and educational systems that basically push kids out. It's a very literal interpretation that turn children away from school. And in my work and in the exploration of this project, the ways in which that push out then facilitates an increased risk of contact with the criminal legal system.
You spent 4 years looking at girls' stories. Where did you look? Where did these girls come from?
You know, I looked at national data sets for some of this work, and that's really where the research exploration began. Though experientially, I've been engaged in this work probably for almost 2 decades, beginning in many ways with my interactions with girls in detention facilities upon the release of my first book in the Bay Area that focused on prostitution. But the narratives in the book actually come from various cities around the country, specifically in the Bay Area, Southern California, New Orleans, Chicago, New York, the Northeast area, and again, pulling narratives from other interactions that I'd had with girls throughout the country. But the strong narratives in the book are included from those cities.
And in such a wide geographic area, what do these girls have in common?
You know, there's a lot that girls have in common, particularly, you know, the black girls that I talked to. I went and prioritized the engagement of girls who had been pushed out. So those, I went straight to those girls who are at the center of our inquiry, those girls who had not completed school, who were in detention facilities, who were under the supervision of the criminal and juvenile legal systems. And overwhelmingly, what these girls had in common was that they had had trouble in schools, and that they had failed to have strong student-teacher relationships that could facilitate their well-being in school. There was a centrality of trauma in their lives, an elevated risk and elevated experience among these girls of having experienced commercial sexual exploitation and other forms of violent victimization, and really an inability for the adults in their lives to understand, see, and respond to these conditions.
Is there any commonality between the school districts we're talking about, or is this just different problems for different areas?
You know, I talked to them about that, and I think there are some things that are absolutely geographically different and that we have to acknowledge as some of the conditions that are different in terms of whether the school uses corporal punishment, for example, or whether the school is a zero-tolerance school or a district that overwhelmingly believes that zero tolerance policies are the appropriate way to respond to the conditions of girls who are behaving in ways that are problematic in schools versus those that don't and have restorative or alternative continua to respond to negative student behavior. And overwhelmingly, I think what is uniform in all of these conditions and why I frame this conversation the way I do is that in some ways, it does absolutely matter whether you have these conditions in place, but what really is at the center of this discussion is how we have come to understand and read the behaviors of black girls such that they are disproportionately negatively impacted by punishment and by punitive policies and practices in response to their behaviors. Kids get in trouble in every school. Kids get in trouble and make mistakes and have to have an opportunity to learn from those mistakes. But the schools where there is a heightened priority around punishment and exclusion, so the use of expulsions and suspensions to respond to negative student behavior, those are the schools that produce girls who don't complete school at the same rates as others. Those are the places where kids in general, and particularly black girls, experience heightened rates of violent victimization in school as well as out. So part of what I want us to think about are the ways in which the national trends around discipline, the condition that black girls are living with, where they are 16% of the percent of girls in schools, but they are overwhelmingly represented, and the only group of girls that are represented or overrepresented in all categories for which data are collected on discipline by the U.S. Department of Education, Office of Civil Rights. So, when we look at these trends around discipline and then we look at the layer around our understanding of their behaviors and how we've constructed identities for them that support or justify our use of exclusionary discipline, then I think we start to understand how, in many ways, it doesn't matter where you are in this country, that black girls are uniquely and in many ways uniformly impacted by the misperceptions that guide adult decision-making and the differential implementation of various policies in ways that render them more vulnerable to exclusion from school.
Have you seen anything that points out the difference between the way that black girls are treated rather than girls are treated?
Other girls?
Yeah.
Some of the narratives that I find most stark in the book are around dress code policies, because we don't tend to think about dress code policies as a practice that can exclude girls from school or that can turn children away from school in a way that can facilitate their failure to complete school. But in my discussions with black girls, they do perceive and describe with great detail the ways in which administrators and other personnel on school campuses have turned them away for wearing the exact same clothing as a white or Asian counterpart. For one example, a girl arrived in short shorts because it was a hot day, and when she arrived in the shorts, she was told she had to go home and change, and she watched a girl come in who, in her opinion, more physically developed than she was, and the administrator looked at her and said, "I'm sorry, she can go to class, you can't, because it looks different on your body." And for her and for many other black girls that I've spoken with, this is actually an issue where, in conversations with girls, they really do come alive in this space because they can perceive and feel the differential impact of these policies and the ways in which the adults in their lives are policing not their clothing but their bodies in these spaces of learning and really placing a prioritization on how they present in schools rather than them being there to learn. And so in many ways, girls, and particularly some of the girls who I profile in Push Out, really begin to share their resistance to these ideas and the punishment that comes when they do resist against this form of misreading or misperception and what they view and what I consider to be oppression.
We've heard stories recently, and in fact you write about it here, about the school-to-prison pipeline. You mostly hear about boys in that. Are girls caught up in that too?
There's no question that girls are impacted by this. And, and I actually stay away from the term school-to-prison pipeline as much as I can, because in our consciousness, in our public discussions about this issue, We've masculinized that idea. We think about the school to prison pipeline, and we immediately think about young people, mostly boys, who are arrested on campus or who come into contact with the criminal and juvenile legal system on campus in ways that can facilitate their increased risk of incarceration or, you know, prison. And yet what I was finding in that conversation about school-to-prison pipeline is that it was a very linear way to describe to describe the phenomenon. And I think that it's an urgent call to action for sure. And so it has a place in our discussion. But when we're talking about girls, I think it's really important for us to explore the multiple pathways that facilitate criminalization, which is a broader issue than just incarceration, and to recognize that for girls, we're talking about, you know, children who are largely not going to be in prison, that they are going to experience other forms of confinement. They may experience, GPS monitoring or informal probation or detention or placement in residential facilities, and that there's a full continuum of confinement options in our juvenile legal system that we often don't name, and so we don't see it. And so my way of engaging with this work is to approach this concept of criminalization by looking at school-to-confinement pathways and to honor and recognize that it's a very dynamic process, not a linear one.
Still to come, our conversation with Dr. Monique Morris continues with a look at the problem of sex trafficking of young girls and how it affects young African Americans. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to The Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Our guest today is Monique Morris, author of Push Out, The Criminalization of Black Girls in Schools. In her book, she talks about the problems of young girls doing sex work. Dr. Morris says it's a problem in all communities, but it disproportionately affects black girls.
It's deeply problematic because in many of our discourses about this issue, we tend to think about sex trafficking as a global phenomenon. And when we see girls on the street domestically, there's a rhetoric around them or used to describe their condition as them choosing to participate in the life. And to me, that framework is deeply problematic and does not reflect the lived experience or the reality that these girls are being habitually raped and sexually exploited, that no one chooses as a child to be in this space, and arguably doesn't even choose as an adult, given it's really about the conditions in their lives. But I call attention to that here because, again, when we talk about the girls who are in contact with the juvenile legal system and the type of criminalization that occurs in the lives of girls, what we've got to do is step backwards and look at what has been happening to them, what has happened in their lives. And many of the girls that we count in our data sets as truant or that we see fighting, these are girls who have experienced commercial sexual exploitation, whether they want to be labeled as a CSEC, which is the acronym we use for commercially sexually exploited child. If they want to be labeled in that way is one thing. You know, that may be inconsistent with their lived experience of actually having felt that they were or having participated in some way in the sex trade. And so, you know, as girls, it's a really important issue for me and for us to explore in the education domain because these girls are not able to come to school. In some cases, girls describe not being able to come to school because of a decision that was not made by them but by the person who was exploiting them. There's a power dynamic here at play that our institutions don't acknowledge. And if our institutions are seeing someone who's at risk of being commercially sexually exploited, they often don't report it as they should as an incident of child abuse. And so it's, we've got to get better at responding to the needs of our girls, but also recognizing them as as experiencing this kind of trauma and victimization, as opposed to just writing off their behaviors as problematic and suspending or expelling them. All that does is place them out on the street. And so the use of exclusionary discipline is very problematic as we think about it in terms of responding to the negative conditions or the negative behaviors that are manifesting in the classroom. And so the greater opportunities we have to improve the kind of wraparound services in schools, the partnerships, the therapists, counselors, et cetera, that have absolutely a place in schools, arguably more so than police in schools, is really important for us to think through these things more critically. And that's what I'm calling attention to.
If you were given a clean slate and you were able to design a school system with black girls in mind, as well as other students too, what would that look like?
Yeah, in my mind, there really have to be four components in place to have an educational system that is conducive to the healthy, well-being of black girls. And, and I think these are things that can benefit other students too. The first is looking at responsive and debiased learning. So at the core of these institutions is this commitment to knowledge and sharing knowledge and really thinking through how we know what we know and how we teach young people to be critical thinkers. To do that, we have to integrate the arts, engage in culturally competent curriculum, allow for there to be interactions and discussions so that children and young people, but girls especially, are invited to bring their voices to a critical examination of topics, and to train teachers and other educators, administrators, and personnel that are interacting with black girls on how to reduce implicit bias and how to manage their own biases when they're interacting with black girls. The second component has to do with healing-informed responses to problematic student behavior. I mentioned earlier that all kids at some point may make a mistake, right? Every student has the potential to make a mistake. But that there have to be school-based alternatives, healing opportunities or restorative opportunities for young people, particularly girls, to repair relationships and to examine what is facilitating this negative behavior rather than just dismissing it as problematic and removing her from school. So to do that, there have to be mentors on campus, co-constructed discipline and dress code policies with girls and the administrators and educators who are working with them. And partnerships, better partnerships between schools and service providers. The third component for me is around healing-informed classrooms and schools. And this builds from the work of the responsive and debiased learning as well as the healing-informed responses to problematic student behavior, in that there should be emotional counseling available to girls. Look at the ways in which student work and student enrichment and group work can help to facilitate the learning among girls. Many of the girls that I interviewed and discussed this topic with for Push Out had attended schools that didn't have breaks or recess. There was no time to play. There was no time to engage. They were not invited to participate in leadership roles in their schools or in sports in their schools. And so there has to be this overall engagement in schools in order for young people to feel the connection and to really respond to the relationship building that girls are asking for. Also, again, to your point around the commercially sexually exploited youth and girls who have already had contact with the juvenile legal system, there has to be an opportunity for them to engage in proactive discussions about healthy intimate partner relationships and healthy relationships in general, because for many of these girls, they have not had that modeled for them. And for girls who are, have the increased risk of contact with the juvenile legal system because of their status as foster youth and some of the concerns that are associated with their involvement in multiple systems, that is even more important, and girls ask for that. And the last piece is really around facilitating college and career pathways, where there can be guest speakers coming in, counseling and consultation, internships, et cetera. And for me, these components, when coupled with the establishment of new ways of engaging with girls out in community that attack and respond to the victimization that they are experiencing, that, can really engage them in healing opportunities and understand, how they are impacted by these conditions that are floating through their lives, but also really talking with girls and boys and women and men about the ways in which sexism and patriarchy negatively impact them, and how we as a community can come together to develop new narratives that are really less about punishment and criminalization and more about healing and restoration.
Well, you point to studies that say that there is progress being made, and you point to some that says we're losing ground. Which is it? How are we doing?
I think we're exploring. We're in both of those locations. This is a work in progress. And for me, with Push Out, I'm hopeful that Push Out is the first of many conversations about how this is impacting our lives and our young people's lives in schools. You know, this conversation about school pushout has been going on for a long time, and just recently now is it beginning to center girls. But I can see comparable projects that really allow us to explore, both with research but also with our own lived experiences and narratives, how school pushout is impacting Latinas. I do include some Latinas in the book, particularly if they identify as Black, but there are other racial groups, ethnic groups, that are impacted also by harsh discipline in schools, and girls who are experiencing negative interactions, you know, on school campuses. The research is in a work in progress.
Dr. Monique Morris is co-founder of the National Black Women's Justice Institute. Her new book is called Push Out, The Criminalization of Black Girls in Schools. It's published by The New Press. So did President Obama's recent trip to Cuba do anything to change race relations on the Caribbean's largest island? That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Will President Obama's recent trip to Cuba help Afro-Cubans? I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of Mount Holyoke College. And today on the Academic Minute, Devin Spence Benson, assistant professor in the Department of History at Louisiana State University, examines the challenges faced by this ethnic group and whether change is on the horizon on the Caribbean island.
On March 22nd, President Barack Obama became the first U.S. president to travel to Cuba since 1928. His visit represented a historic thawing in diplomatic relations between the two countries. But what did the POTUS, touching down on the Caribbean's largest island, mean for Cubans of African descent? Back when Presidents Obama and Raul Castro first announced the normalization of relations in 2014, I emailed friends on the island to see how they were taking the news. An Afro-Cuban intellectual hesitantly told me, "We will see what happens." She expressed cautious optimism that economic opens in Cuba would improve the lives of Cubans of color. Obama's speech in Havana's Gran Teatro a few weeks ago offered an answer to her implied question. After speaking about continued racial discrimination in both the U.S. and Cuba, Obama said, "In Cuba, we want our engagement to help lift up the Cubans who are of African descent." This was an important point, especially since visitors to Cuba don't always see the ways Black Cubans continue to be left behind by new economic reforms. During their short vacations, many tourists don't notice how Afro-Cubans are discreetly barred entrance into tourist hotels or have limited access to good-paying front-of-the-house jobs in major hotels. Many Cubans were enthusiastic about Obama's visit, especially Cubans of color, who felt empowered by the image of a confident Black leader and his family. But others attacked Obama's sincerity. When an official newspaper article, ironically written by a Black Cuban, insulted Obama, Afro-Cuban activists responded to these attacks quickly, calling them racist. As we wait to see, it appears that for Afro-Cubans, the struggle for dignity and against racism continues.
That was Devin Spence Benson of Louisiana State University. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio, in partnership with Mount Holyoke College. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to our podcast or any of the other National Productions podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org.